Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, we celebrate Arbor Day by driving off the main highway and hitting the open road to search for the trees and woodlands that have been instrumental in defining Wisconsin's identity as a state and an economy that depends not just on Northwoods tourism, but also a lumber industry that supplies fine wood products for homes and the pulp for our paper mills. Our guest today, R. Bruce Allison, one of Wisconsin's top experts on trees, the author of several books on the subject, including a new children's book called If Trees Could Talk, a book that describes the individual trees that have helped determine Wisconsin's history. Allison is also the author of Every Root and Anchor, Wisconsin Champion Trees, and two guidebooks, Tree Walks of Madison and Dane County and Tree Walks of Milwaukee County. He is an adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, and he is the owner of Allison Tree Care Incorporated. He is there to provide you with advice and tips for growing trees on your property and giving them the care they need to survive and flourish. As always, we want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments about Bruce's books, about the history of trees, their significance to Wisconsin, or if you've got tree care questions that you'd like Bruce to answer, we do invite you to give us a call at 261-6371. That's 261-6371. Or if you are outside the Wausau area, toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Bruce, welcome to Route 51.
Well, Glenn, thank you very much. I very much appreciate having a chance to be with you and your listeners.
What got you interested in trees?
Well, you know, one of those childhood things. I have always loved being around trees. I loved climbing trees. I'd gone to college, was an English major, and decided when I was just graduating from college to work for an arborist out east. And he was such an inspirational person. He was really a gentleman of arboriculture and the trees out in Baltimore, Maryland. He really inspired me. I was his apprentice for a while, and then when I was still a young man, showed up in Wisconsin back in the early 70s and started my own tree care company. And I've been going ever since, and I couldn't think of a better occupation for me. It fits so perfectly.
Well, let's get into tree care off the bat. We'll talk about your books in a second here. But Allison Tree Care Incorporated, where are you located?
I'm located in Madison, Wisconsin. Have, as I say, been here since the 70s. And the company for many years was a total tree care company, providing pruning, removals, in addition to treatments of trees. About 10 years ago, I decided just to focus on the consulting and the treatments of trees so that I could be of help to more people with more specialized tools. And one of my specialties these days is doing analysis of the structure of trees and to determine if you have instability, internal decay, using some very sophisticated new tools that, believe me, when I started many years ago, we couldn't even imagine, but something called acoustic tomography, where we're able to use sound waves to be able to determine the level of decay and defect on the inside.
Well, I guess it's like everything else. Technology is moving ahead at a very fast pace. I know in my own business, the radio news business, when I started here, we used to cut audio tape with a razor blade and tape, and now everything is computerized, and it's amazing what you can do. What kind of questions are homeowners calling you with this time of the year? Why don't you give me your top two or three calls from homeowners?
Well, you know, people are, you know, even though they're not active right now, worried about pests. And we have a huge pest entering Wisconsin that's going to affect really probably the whole state, and that's emerald ash borer. Already two or three counties have been quarantined, and it when it came into the Detroit area in the early part of this century, that is, you know, the 2003, I think it arrived, 20 million ash trees were taken out. We have 766 million ash trees in the state of Wisconsin, and in urban areas, because ash was such a good replacement for the elm, we thought. We have 20% on average stocking of ash trees in city areas.
So you have a situation where the elms were killed by the Dutch elm disease, and now we've got a pest that might take out their replacements.
That's correct. So people, you know, have seen that in the news and are very concerned about, you know, how that might affect them. And so that's of issue.
Is there any way you can fight the emerald ash borer, or is it just a matter of us trying to keep it from our forests, keep it away as long as we can?
I think initially there was thought that maybe eradication would be a possibility. I think the Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection, and the Department of Natural Resources, who are really managing all of this in the state, have come to the conclusion that now it's a matter of management, not eradication. And there are certainly some chemicals, some pesticides that, if properly applied in the soil, would give it some level of protection or inject it directly into the trunk. But they're really only applicable if you have an infection that is, say, you know, 12 to 15 miles away and you're worried about an immediate threat to your trees.
And it sounds like it's something that you've got to catch early.
And you really would do well to do it preventatively as opposed to trying to treat an infected tree therapeutically. It becomes really difficult.
Well, how are we doing on the emerald ash borer? Is it making inroads in our state in any significant way right now?
Yes. As I say, in Crawford County and Vernon County, these now are quarantined. Just a couple weeks ago, the most recent infestation was discovered there in Vernon County, little town called Victory, which isn't too far from La Crosse, and of course right near the Mississippi River. So we have it in this moment on the east side of the state, on the west side of the state, and it's in northern Illinois, and we're sort of in a vise, and it's definitely moving up.
And so, here it comes, and I guess if you're a camper, one of the most important things is not to move your firewood from one area to another, because that can also move the bug.
That's correct, Glenn, and it's amazing. This critter, if it moves by itself, only moves about a mile or so a year. However, it's people that become the vectors of this particular insect, and so we have a very important role in not moving those ash logs from one spot to the other. So that's a very, very important component of the management of this particular pest.
Bruce Allison, we're talking about trees, their care, what you have to do to make them thrive and flourish in your environment. And we'll also be talking to Bruce about some of the books he's written about trees, including a new children's book, If Trees Could Talk. But right now, let's go to the phones, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Eric and Ringel, you're on Route 51. Hello, Eric.
Hi, Glenn and Bruce. This fall, I'd like to put about 500 white oak into a nursery bed for 2 years. They'll be four to 14 inches. And then I'd like to put them out in my field. And what kind of field spacing should I expect?
Well, that's a good point, and I'm so glad you're planting these oaks. Are you acquiring the stock from the Department of Natural Resources nurseries?
Nope, from my task out of Minnesota.
Okay, so you've got a private supplier there. Well, it depends a little bit upon, you know, how you are, you know, planting them and the type of field you have. But, you know, ultimately, you're probably going to be looking at some attrition going on. And I would suggest that the recommendation probably is at that, 10 to 12-foot spacing for these trees. It also depends upon what kind of management of that oak plantation you intend to have. I mean, do you intend to take them out when they're younger, or do you want to let them grow to, an 80, 90-year rotation? That'll also impact the kind of spacing you have. The trick is to get them far apart enough where they can gather an adequate amount of sunlight, where you can manage the forest floor underneath, because, you know, especially for those first years, you have to keep any additional vegetation down, and that usually means herbicide use or getting in there and mowing. So you want to have plenty of space for that. But you want to have them close enough so that they tend to grow in a more upright and more trunk as opposed to lateral branches growing out. So I would, you plan to put it into the managed forest program?
I do not.
You do not, okay. And your purpose is indeed for a forest product. You're not just planting them for animal habitat and to recreate a natural forest setting, or what is your purpose?
It's pretty much strictly for wildlife habitat.
For wildlife habitat. Well, then you can afford to put them a little further apart, because then you want to have larger branch growing. But again, keep in mind that you're inevitably going to have, you know, a significant amount of attrition no matter what you do. Do you have an irrigation potential here?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. Well, and even a tanker truck or something like that if we go into a serious drought situation?
That I do have access to.
Okay. Because you're going to be looking at, you know, if you had a drought and you've got a big investment in those plants, not only in terms of the cost of the plant, but also in the labor to put them in properly. And so if you went through a drought situation, you wouldn't want to suddenly find yourself in the first, you know, 2 or 3 years with 100% mortality, which certainly could happen. The good news is once those oaks get established, they tend to have a, you know, great resistance to drought, much more so than many of the other species, especially evergreens and so on.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, thanks so much for the phone call. We have had drought years, Bruce, and a lot of them over the past, the past few years have been just really nasty. How has that affected the health of trees in our state, and what species are if you're going to plant something, what species would do better under drought conditions than others?
Well, again, as I say, those species that, oaks, for example, which have evolved in a environment where drought was part of the ecology, and so they tend to have greater resistance. So avoiding any plants that, have developed in lowland or, more wetty environments, obvious ones, or you're not going to plant them for forest product, but in an urban setting, in especially a residential setting, people might want to plant a willow or something like that, and they're not going to do well in a high drought situation. But oaks, once they're established and have a nice, in the early juvenile stage, a nice deep taproot, are more tolerant. And the reason I know that oaks have evolved in an environment where the drought was a normal part of the ecology is the fact that the leaves don't drop during the winter. You might have noted that.
Right, right.
And that's because they don't have an abscission cell. An abscission cell is that connection between the twig and the leaf petiole. That's the stem of the leaf. There is a little cell which in most other species, cherries, maples, ash, whatever, will, at the right moment, as things start to dry out, will shrivel up first and disconnect or decouple that leaf from the stem.
Mm-hmm.
Those oaks did not have that, and you can imagine that if a drought came in and they dropped too prematurely, then they would have to go through the whole effort of sending out new leaves. And so they didn't develop that, or those, more precisely, those individuals that didn't have an abscission cell, genetically didn't have an abscission cell, survived in that kind of environment. So I would say that oaks would be, one of those choices that would be more tolerant of a droughty situation. Hackberries would be somewhat more tolerant of droughty situation. The other problem is...
What about pines, Bruce? What kind of pine trees could you plant?
Well, pines are a problem, and if you have gone out west, to Colorado or, to Idaho, even Utah in the mountain areas, you look at the mountainsides, and it is just so sad to see huge numbers of those pines that are all browned and dying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're browned and dying because of a couple factors, but one is the droughty situation has stressed those plants. They have been infested with Ips pinei, which is a pine bark beetle. The white pines, the red pines that we have here are very subject to a pine bark beetle, which is a ubiquitous insect. It's always around. But if that tree is stressed, it's unable to defend itself. And so the beetle is attracted to that tree under stress. It lays its eggs. The larva then goes in, and it feeds just beneath the bark. They're true bark beetles, and they sever those vascular cells, and then the tree fails. A healthy tree with adequate moisture during normal, moisture situation has a sufficient amount of sap and moisture inside to be able to pitch out that invading larval borer larval, and you know, then the story is over with. But if it can't, so I would say it's certainly white pine and red pine. Red pine are more drought tolerant than white pine, but by and large, the pines can be subject to these secondary insects that come in and during droughty situations.
Bruce Allison of Allison Tree Care Incorporated. He is also the author of a number of books on trees and their importance in Wisconsin's history, Wisconsin's environment, its ecology, and its identity as a state. We'll be talking to him about if trees could talk on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio right after this.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guest today, Bruce Allison of Allison Tree Care Incorporated. He is with us today to give you advice on planting trees and caring for trees on your property. And he's also here to talk about a children's book that he wrote called If Trees Could Talk. Let me give you those numbers again, 261-6371. That's 261-6371 if you're in the Wausau area, or toll-free 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Bruce, what motivated you to write a children's book?
Well, this book is a children's version of Every Root and Anchor, and I think you mentioned that was an earlier book that I'd done and was published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press in 2005, which is a collection of the histories associated with many trees throughout the state. And I've been gathering those stories for the past 20 years or so, building upon the work of a man who was with the Department of Conservation, which was a precursor institution to the Department of Natural Resources, a man by the name of Walter Scott, and also the work of Robert Gard, who was a professor at the University of Wisconsin for many years. And then we got letters from just people throughout the state telling us, you know, their story, and from newspapers talking about famous trees in different corners of the state. And that book was very well received by an adult audience. I thought it was just really important to present these histories early on to the young people in the state. And so,
and it is really a kind of a cool book, because you can all the chapters are just very short, just a few paragraphs with a picture of the tree that you're describing, and it just talks about individual trees and what they meant for Wisconsin's history at particular points in time.
That's right. Yeah, trees are, you know, remarkable in the landscape because they're the oldest things around. You know, the oldest tree in the world is over 5,000 years old. And in the state of Wisconsin, we have, you know, 500-year-old trees. So they have lived longer than the generations that passed by, and so they become markers, if you will, and witnesses of the things that, you know, we as people have brought to the land also.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a phone call from Paul, who is on the road right now. And, Paul, you've got a question about red pines?
Yeah. Last fall, I had a big, giant pine tree. She got hit by hail, and I had to remove it last year. I dug the stump out real good, and then I bought a real nice, about a four-foot alpine, red pine, I think it's called. And I put it in last fall. It was doing real good, and we got pretty good snow this year and that. Well, now in the spring here on the south side, it's all red.
Yeah.
But there is some new shoots coming out of it, but it's depressing, man. It's my new tree.
Yeah, exactly. It always is. And it's those first few years after you plant a new plant that they're particularly vulnerable. And the reason is that when they've been dug out from a nursery, inevitably, some of the roots have been left back, and so your root-to-crown ratio, that is the number of roots left that were servicing that particular crown, have been reduced in size, and so you get a stress situation, and it just doesn't have the nutrients to be able to tolerate it as well. And particularly when you have, you know, some significant cold weather and then maybe a little warming, especially on that south side, and those pines, being evergreens, will continue to desiccate or dry out. That is, they're not like the deciduous trees that drop their leaves so they can't lose moisture anymore. They have to hold on to their needles, and there's little holes or stomata, which the moisture then leaves.
Well, Bruce, any advice on what Paul can do with this critically ill patient of his?
Yes. Well, what I would do, number one, is just give it a little bit more and see if indeed you might have some what's known as adventitious shooting coming out. You're not going to have much on an evergreen, but you know, we just don't know how severely damaged those cells were. You might be able to get some green coming out. And even though you're sort of browned on one side, if you have a sufficient amount of crown around the other side, I mean more than 50%, you might be able to produce enough carbohydrates this year to be able to grow higher up and send out, you know, new growth from the upper part of the crown. So I wouldn't give up yet.
The part that's brown, though, is that pretty much history?
Yes, the part that's brown is pretty much history. I would minimally, I'd kind of shake off those dead needles.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're going to have any new growth. But, you know, again, as I say, just be patient a little bit on that side and see if you can get some regrowth around the edges or from that trunk higher up where you do have some embedded buds that might be able to come out.
I put in the same variety, a smaller one, about 18 inches, and that did the same thing.
Well, I'm certainly seeing throughout the state just this situation. We must have had just those right weather conditions that were, you know, very difficult for fairly newly planted trees, and newly could be up for the first 3 years. You'll have less of that as you get a more established root system and the tree has more vigor as it goes into the winter. And there's
Paul, we got to run. I got a news break coming up. Thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bruce Allison, he's taking your phone calls on tree care and advice for maintaining that healthy tree, that healthy landscape in your yard. He'll also be talking about his book, If Trees Could Talk, 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark, home of Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex brands, dedicated to social, economic, and environmental responsibility. Information about Kimberly-Clark is on the web at kimberly-clark.com.
We are back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Today we're celebrating Arbor Day. One day early with Bruce Allison, one of the state's top experts on trees, tree care, and also their history, their significance to the state of Wisconsin. He has a book out. It's a children's book called If Trees Could Talk, and we will be discussing that with him, as well as answering your questions about how to care for the trees in your home or landscape. Our phone number is, again, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Let's go back to the phones. Tony in Wisconsin Rapids, you're on Route 51. Hello, Tony.
Yes, good afternoon, Glenn and Bruce. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I would like to know what trees stand a higher probability of success rate for planting on the outskirts of wetlands. I own land in the northern part of Wisconsin.
Northern part of Wisconsin and near the wetlands. How wet is the soil?
I would say you're probably standing in about maybe 10 inches at times.
Oh, boy. So it's very, very wet.
It can be.
Yeah, it's a flood zone, and that presents some real problems. Well, let's talk about the evergreens first, you know, what might be a possibility there. And really the only evergreens that I think are going to be able to tolerate that, you know, an occasional flood situation are the arborvitae, which you probably have, you know, plenty of in that area. But, you know, again, 10 inches of water sitting during a long period during the spring can cause a flood response immediately, but also if it gets too wet can generate a problem with the root rot. And so you have a variety of different soil fungi that can actually, over time, slow down the growth of that tree and actually start to decay some of the roots. But nonetheless, that's probably the only evergreen I can think of that can tolerate that. You certainly, you know, also with the, you know, the tamarack larch family,
yes,
they can tolerate a certain level of it also. Although people mistakenly think of those as, you know, favoring wetlands, but in point of fact, they're very shade intolerant, and they do best where there's no competition, and so that's why you tend to see more of those tamarack and, you know, or larch. I mean, there's close relationship between the two in those, you know, more hydric or wet areas. For the deciduous plants, you know, you've got a, you know, very limited palette there. You probably observed along river banks where you have, you know, occasional flooding, ash seem to do quite well. I can't encourage you to plant ash at this particular point because of the introduction of the emerald ash borer.
Yes.
But that was one that actually did fairly well.
What about willow trees, Bruce, or are we too
far
north of that?
Well, and again, if you're choosing to go that way, I mean, willow are, you know, shorter lived. They're, you know, quite brittle, subject to wind damage. But, of course, they, you know, can do quite well in a very, you know, in a fairly wet environment. No plant can tolerate long periods of flooding. You can see this, you know, where we've had very significant, you know, flood areas along the Mississippi over, you know, years in the past, or even along the Wisconsin River, because roots need to respire. They need oxygen in order to do that. And if you take away that oxygen for too long a time during an area, a time of rapid growth, which is spring, early summer, for too long a period, then they just don't thrive. I would, you know, take a look and see what is naturally growing in that area. I mean, you might have some box elders maybe, you know, coming up in that area. You might even have some cottonwoods. But I suspect what you're really asking me is, you know, what better quality species can we put in there that have longer life and are not much of a maintenance. Is that accurate?
Yes, I'm trying to create a little more of a diversity,
yes,
possibly even some type of a food source, if possible.
Yes.
And just to enhance the area in general.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are probably things that you should be taking a look at, some of the varieties of willows. You know, for the smaller plants, and, you know, sort of go from a small tree down to a shrub, you know, some of the dogwood could probably tolerate growing in that particular environment. There's not a lot of choices you have in terms of, you know, the more desirable forest-type trees in that, you know, oak, hickory, cherry blend. And as I say, I think the only evergreen that is going to have any kind of choice there, and it's an excellent one for wildlife habitat, is the arborvita.
Well, have you heard any rumor about the red maple being allowed in that type of...
Well, the red maple, if you're going to select from the maples, I mean, again, it's not one that's going to last very long, but the true Acer rubrum, which is the red maple as opposed to the Norway red maple, like the Schweidler, the Crimson King, could be, you know, more tolerant of that. But again, try to select sites that are not going to sit in that water for a long time. So those that have a little bit more elevation, and you could plant just the straight, you know, native red maple, or you could choose some of the varieties, which are, you know, the Freeman Eye particularly. The Freeman Eye is a cultivated variety of the Acer rubra, which couple different popular varieties, which are actually crosses with the silver maple, could do fairly well too. The Autumn Blaze, the Autumn Applause, these are some possibilities for you too. And I would be cautious though, and just don't put them in some place where you know there's going to be just, you know, long periods of poor drainage going on. But yes, that's another choice. The sugars aren't going to do it. The Norways are probably going to have some root rot issues, but, you know, some of the red maples might be a possibility and certainly worth a try. I mean, it's kind of this question-answer period depending upon the conditions of the soil. You put something in, see if it works. If it does, then you get a positive answer, and if it doesn't. So that's one way to move ahead with some diversity.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Tony, thanks so much for the phone call. We've been talking about planting drought-resistant trees and now trees that can survive in wetlands. Bruce, what about the whole question of climate change? How is that affecting the forests of Wisconsin? And could we see some actual changes in the North Woods where our beautiful pine forests might be at risk if the climate continues to warm?
Absolutely. That's a great concern to, you know, both the U.S. Forest Service and the Forestry Bureau of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. A huge concern. And they're very focused on that, and the University of Wisconsin is doing quite a bit of research in those areas to try to better understand what is going to happen with these weather changes. Its interest is that the weather changes are not uniform, that there are certain areas that are getting more rain, so we have, you know, too much moisture, other areas getting a droughty situation. It can all happen, you know, within the same state. So it becomes a little bit confusing as to how the environment's really going to change. So, yes, we certainly are going to see some changes going on.
What we've heard from some people is that our pine forests up north are at risk, and we might end up having more of a mix of deciduous trees similar to what we have in the southern part of the state.
Yes, because if you take a look at the new U.S. Department of Agriculture, you know, climate zone or planting zones, you'll see that the zones are moving up. They're moving up the areas that, you know, used to be, you know, a 3 or now a 4, and areas that used to be 4 are now a 5. So it's pushing up. Things are changing along the way. And, of course, that plants that you're talking about are well-suited for a certain set of temperature variables.
Mm-hmm.
And if you change those variables, there are going to be some losers and some winners, and things are going to change dramatically. Plus, as I spoke before, you introduce a whole new set of insects. When you have warmer winters, you have more of the
Bugs don't die.
They don't die, exactly. You have, you know, less attrition going on, so you have a higher percentage of insects, and that changes the calculus going on there. Suddenly, you've got more insects than that population of trees was able to tolerate. Whatever you have, I mean, proper planting, you know, the right spacing in adequate soils will always help, because you want to have vigorous individual plants that are more tolerant. Just like a population of people or mammals, those that are more vigorous and healthy can survive some of the changes that happen. You know, the hot summers, it's always, you know, the elderly or those people that have a compromised health that are more subject.
Same thing with trees.
Same thing with trees going on. And thinking about greater diversity is very important, you know, sort of preparing for that, to planting some, you know, additional trees. And, you know, in looking at, you know, how one can, you know, manipulate, I mean, we have to be able to adapt as things change, and the plants can do it to a certain extent. Hopefully, over time, scientists can come up with red pines that they've carefully selected that are more tolerant of warmer winters, for example, maybe more tolerant of some of the secondary insects that come in. So I think, you know, we're not without some defense as things change here. And on the other end, you know, what do we do about this whole concept of having excess carbon in the air? Well, plants, you know, are really the answer. I mean,
plant more trees, and that'll reduce the carbon.
Absolutely. They take in that carbon dioxide and convert, they send it back to us as carbohydrates and as oxygen. Far better to sequester that carbon in those trees than to have it in the atmosphere where it's affecting, you know, climate.
We're talking to Bruce Allison, one of the state's top tree experts on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg. We'll be back with more of your questions about tree care and more about Bruce's book, If Trees Could Talk, right after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Our guest today, Bruce Allison on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're taking your calls for him. He's an expert on trees in the state of Wisconsin. If you've got a question about tree care, give us a call at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. But right now, Bruce, I want to talk about If Trees Could Talk, your children's book, which, as we described in the last half hour, actually looks at some of the important and significant trees in the history of Wisconsin, some of them still standing, some of them not standing at this point in time. But what is your hope in terms of getting this published as a children's book? What message do you hope to send to the kids who read it?
Well, I'm hoping that the children will recognize that these trees indeed are witnesses of our history and have a visual metaphor, if you will, of the depth of the history that we have in the state. There's some stories associated with the Civil War that were sign-up trees during the 1860s, young Wisconsinites gathered beneath these trees to sign up to defend the Union and go off to war. Many of them didn't return. Those trees still stand, and I'm hoping that these young children will look at those trees, which still exist, and know that history and have a greater appreciation of those things that came before.
Now, some of the trees in north central Wisconsin, you've got the Haunted Mansion and the Pines of Merrill is one of the entries.
A wonderful story, and again, it tells in almost a quasi-humorous way, the relationship of this hill and the trees. It was the Native Americans had been there originally, and the
It was the daughter of the chief named Jenny.
Jenny.
And Merrill used to be called Jenny before they changed the name.
Very interesting. Well, so Jenny was buried here. She had succumbed to a disease brought by the early lumbering Europeans that came in there. And the chief said, whoever defiles this land, shall ever be cursed. Well, one of the early mayors, in fact, the first mayor of Merrill, who was T.B. Scott in 1883, decided to build his mansion on top of this hill. Of course, there's some great white pines there. It must have been a wonderful sight for him.
He should have listened to the Native Americans.
Should have listened to the Native Americans, because the story goes, and it just came from the Historical Society there in Merrill, that he died, his wife continued, she died, his son continued, and he died in a battle with the architect over whether or not the area was haunted. And then a caretaker took over, and that caretaker took a vacation back to his home in England and returned in 1912 on the biggest ship ever built. And, of course, that happened to be the Titanic. And he also lost his life and finally was given to a group of nuns in 1923.
And that finally killed the curse, apparently.
And the curse was killed, but the trees watched all of that and carried on. So, again, that's one of the messages I hope these young people can see, is that there's a lot of history that surrounds them if they can just look back.
And to mention some of the other trees just real quickly, we had the Civil War sign-up trees, also hanging trees in a couple of communities.
Exactly. In Durand County Courthouse back in 1881, Ed Williams shot a couple of the sheriffs that came to arrest him, and he was pulled out early before the trial and hung there from a black locust tree. And that's one of the terrible way to use a tree, but it stuck is a very interesting part.
It's certainly part of our history. Also trees that were significant in the Black Hawk War.
Yes.
And trees that were used as trail markers by Native Americans. A General MacArthur white pine in the Nicolet Forest up north,
which is no longer with us. It came down in 2003, sadly, but that was one of the largest and most interesting trees. It was discovered in 1945, and of course one of our native sons was General Douglas MacArthur, and so it was named after him. Great tree, and it just tells you that some of those early lumbering people, the lumberjacks particularly, even though they were cutting down a lot of trees at that time, when they saw a special interesting specimen, they had respect for that also and decided to keep this tree. And so it was actually one of the very largest white pine in the United States. and was a wonderful tree to visit and to bring young people by to see what great trees, you know, once inhabited the entire part of that part of the state.
And another tree that's part of our history here in north central Wisconsin, the Cram Houghton Blaze Tree in Trout Lake up in Vilas County.
Exactly. Fascinating story. And that part of that tree still remains in the State Historical Society Museum in Madison. Thomas Jefferson Cram was a surveyor, and of course before we could become a state in 1848, it had to be properly surveyed. The surveyors at that time didn't have all of the GPS and the metal they could put in the ground, so they used trees and blazed them and wrote their name to identify them as corner markers. And this tree was found many years later.
Several decades later, there it is.
Several decades later, exactly. And so it's a good representation of how technology has changed also.
And you also go into Aldo Leopold's good oak, his pine forest, which he planted around his shack in the Baraboo area that, you know, we've talked about drought already. It took several times for him to get that forest to grow the way it should because of the dry conditions during the 30s. There's also a buried forest, a pleasant prairie near Kenosha, all kinds of interesting things involving the history of the trees of Wisconsin. It's a great children's book. It's called If Trees Could Talk. And if you're looking for something to buy a youngster this Arbor Day, which is tomorrow, I think you couldn't go wrong with picking up a copy of that. Let's go back to our phones right now. We do have time for one more tree care question. We'll go to Craig in Little Chicago. Craig, you're on Route 51.
Thank you. I planted a bunch of just two-year-old...
Craig, could you speak up, please? We've got a bad connection.
I planted a bunch of two-year-old and three-year-old trees last summer around my farm, and over the winter I had mice chewing on them. Any idea, any recommendation?
Well, what species were they, Craig?
The hard maple were hit the worst.
The maple,
they seemed to leave alone.
Yeah. Well, you probably had something called meadow vole, which that's meadow vole, V-O-L-E. Very common. They, you know, look like little mice, but they're a little bit different. They have a more pronounced snout. And they absolutely love fruit trees and sugar maples because of the higher sugar content. And during the winter, they just debark that entire area. If it's totally girdled very deeply, you probably aren't going to have any survival of those. However, if it's just partially girdled or if it was just the outer area and you still had some growth along the cambial tissue, you might have survival there. What you want to do is in the following year, in order to reduce the amount of meadow vole damage, is control any tall grass that might be in that area, which means mowing it down, and you might have to use an herbicide around the base of those trees so that you don't have the habitat in which these meadow voles can get established.
I think most of the damage came in under the snow.
Well, exactly, and that's where the meadow voles are going to be, but they're going to have...
Keeping the grass away would help even...
Exactly, because they build up populations early on. Orchardists are always dealing with the same problem. And so, you know, occasionally, if the damage is higher up, it might have been rabbits coming in. But if it's at the base, especially if it's underneath the snow, it was most likely the meadow vole. The rabbit damage, when you have a deep snow, will be higher up. And, of course, they'll also do both nibbling on the buds and the smaller branches and some debarking going on. But the meadow vole are very thorough. They have much smaller teeth and can just strip that whole area.
And really, I guess the only sure way to prevent that is to, you know, put chicken wire around the trees or wrap them.
Well, chicken wire is not going to do it because these meadow vole are able to get through.
It'll keep the rabbits away.
Keep the rabbits away, exactly. Keep the rabbits and the deer browse away.
Well, these little seedlings are smaller than a pencil.
Yeah,
well, there you
small.
Go.
Exactly. And so, you know, give them a little bit more chance because sometimes if you, you know, have just, a, you know, even, you know, 40% of the remaining basket or cells, you might have survivability on those smaller ones. And so, you know, one possibility, really managing the what's known as the forest floor, even though it's, you know, just a new planting area, is the best way to handle that. And I would be almost inclined to try to use, you know, an herbicide in among there for the first couple years anyway. And if you do decide to put up something to keep them away, it has to go slightly into the ground. It has to be a very small hole that the meadow vole cannot get through. If you have a chance, you know, Google on your computer meadow vole or get to the University Extension bulletin on it, and you'll see the insect, and you'll see the little mammal that's doing the damage, and you'll recognize, you know, its characteristics. You can actually see its incisor teeth on the wood if you look really carefully with a hand lens.
Craig, thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And we're down to our last couple of minutes here. And, Bruce, I thought we'd end by talking about a poem that appears in your book, If Trees Could Talk, a poem written by Joyce Kilmer about trees right here in Wisconsin. I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree.
And that poem came out in 1913. It was just a huge hit throughout the United States. It just really touched a chord among people. And Joyce Kilmer was actually from New York, but he began visiting Campion College in Prairie du Chien and swore that after he came back from fighting in the First World War, he would become a Wisconsinite. And unfortunately, Joyce Kilmer died as a doughboy in Europe.
But he left that poem as his gift to all of us who love trees and also to those of us who love trees in Wisconsin.
Yes, absolutely.
Bruce Allison, thanks so much for your time. And that book, again, is it's a new children's book, If Trees Could Talk. You can also reach Bruce at Allison Tree Care Incorporated. His website is allisontree.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Kelson Quisler. Next week, we go from flora to fauna as we welcome Stan Tequila to our Route 51 studios. Tequila, a world-renowned wildlife photographer and the author of several regional books on birds and their behavior as the spring migration season goes into full swing. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until next week, we are heading out of town.